I looked at the roster, I looked at the team, I looked at the history that you guys have had, and, you know, I was like, man, I need to be a part of it.
You can't factor out a fullback if you want to have a balanced offense. So I say that, you know, the fullback spot is not a dying breed. I say it's coming back even more.
That was probably the worst and the best day of my life. I was with my mom. We actually cried of frustration and tears of joy at the same time.
Welcome into the lounge for what's a really good episode. This one, I'll tell you what, money.
It's good. What we're going to do today is we decided there's always this appetite for getting to know the undrafted rookies every single year. People want to know. That's like the main question we get. As soon as the draft is over, rather than people asking about like the first and second round pick, it's like, yeah, who are the Ravens going to sign as undrafted free agents? Which undrafted free agents have the best chance to make the roster?
Who's the hidden gem?
Yeah, who's the hidden gem? Literally, after every single draft, the top, the story that gets the most traffic on our website and on our app is almost always
Ravens signed 15 undrafted free agents.
Every single
year. I could write that headline.
Without fail. Without fail. And what we're going to do today is we want to introduce you to three of the undrafted free agents who are on this team who have a little bit of buzz about them. And it's Ricky Ortiz, the fullback out of Oregon State, Tim White, the wide receiver, kick returner, punt returner out of Arizona State, and Taequann Mizell, the running back. Smoke is his nickname. Out of Virginia. So we caught up with all three of them and just had some really interesting conversations.
Before we get into that, we have a good email. And as always, you can reach us at thelounge@ravens.nfl.net. Go ahead, Garrett.
Great email. This is from Sven.
You're going to butcher this last name.
Schlowowski.
Dude, no. No, he's from what? Germany?
Sven Schlowowski. 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 Yeah.
Sounds Polish.
It does sound Polish, but the email says, since I live in Germany, the NFL wasn't really popular here until about 1 to 2 years ago, and I have to admit I am a Ravens fan only since the Mile High Miracle. So we have a new Ravens fan.
Good time to jump on board. That was a good time to jump on board.
Exactly.
Baby.
If there's a time to get on the bandwagon, not bad. And so it's a long email, so I won't read all of it, but he says that as I heard the Ravens were selected to play in London, it was tough for me to find other friends who would go to the game with me to watch in England. He did recruit some friends to come there. He's going to be there in Wembley, and he says that he needs us to let him know what pub we're going to go to.
Yeah, he wants to be, basically, he's in Germany. He's the only Ravens fan in Germany, or so he thinks, and he's just really pumped to be, like, in a place where there's tons of Ravens fans so he can kind of feel at home for once.
Right. So, and so
we're going to make that home for him. We're still deciding. This is a little teaser. We, as we've said on this podcast, Garrett and I will both be in London, and we are deciding what pub we're going to be at to have the lounge taped live from the pub. Maybe we'll throw back a beer or two. Maybe.
Yeah, and maybe. We have, there's been some scouting trips across over to London, and there's one that's, I think,
standing out. We might do it live too, fans. We might bring some fans on. That's just a little teaser. It's gonna be a good time.
Yeah. So stay tuned for that. Can't wait for it, and we'll keep everyone posted in terms of what pub we will be at and when we're gonna have that live episode of the Lounge from London. So, thank you very much for the email, Sven.
Yeah. So with no further ado, let's jump into our first interview with returner / wide receiver Tim White. Tim, you know, we just want to get to know you a little bit better. And first of all, I want to kind of start at the beginning with you, with your childhood. Tell us a little bit about where you grew up in California and what it was like there.
Yeah, I grew up in, you know, Los Angeles, California. You know, kind of moved all over the place, you know, especially during, you know, my high school or, you know, junior middle school area, you know, times. But, you know, it was definitely tough times, you know, for my parents. I have a large family, 7 sisters and 1 brother.
Wow.
And, you know, we just been all over, you know, experienced everything, you know, definitely hard times growing up. And, you know, my parents, they managed to get us through it and kept us positive throughout those times. So a lot of those tough times, they, you know, they seem hard, but, you know, looking back at it, it makes you smile and, you know, just enjoy the times that you were there with your sisters and your brothers, and you fought through it and got through it with them.
So could you elaborate a little bit on what those hard times were exactly?
Yeah, definitely, you know, sleeping in cars and, you know, just hardships, real tough times. You know, homelessness, you know, was one of the big things for me, and, you know, that was one of those things that I experienced oftentimes when I was younger. You know, our parents managed to get us in hotels and, you know, sometimes apartments or houses at times, but, you know, just the consistency of homelessness, you know, growing up.
When you have to go through that and deal with those struggles and those hardships, how does that prepare you for really the rest of your life? I feel like if you were to go through that, you probably feel like you can beat anything that you face later on in life.
Exactly. It definitely shapes your mindset and, you know, your character as you get older. And that's one of the things is when I look back at it, you know, and understand, when I really realize what I really went through, is like, wow, you know, I could get through anything. And, you know, it definitely builds your skin, you know, it makes you have tough skin and, you know, just lets you know who you are.
Did you even realize when you were going through it that it was as hard times, or was that just what you were in, that you didn't necessarily know good or bad, but this was just what your situation was?
Yeah. At the time, I just thought it was what it was. You know, mm-hmm. I didn't really look at it like, you know, I'm homeless or anything. Our parents, you know, I'm sure all the pressure was on them. You know, they had seven of my sisters to look out for and one brother. So, but, you know, we were just kids, you know, going through everything. We had real fun adventures and, you know, just experienced things that, you know, a lot of other kids wouldn't experience, honestly. But, you know, we did it and we had fun doing it.
How long was the period when you were bouncing around? Was it your entire childhood or what?
I would say so. Definitely my entire childhood growing up. It wasn't always, you know, homelessness, but it was, you know, definitely on and off. And
right.
There were times that were longer than others and times where it was, you know, longer than others opposite, you know, where we were in the house for a long time. But
right. Definitely
once I got to my sophomore year of high school, when I moved to Hart High School, that's when the stability came and we were in the house until, you know, I graduated high school and all of that. So
right. Is there one time that sticks out in your head that was especially difficult, or one time that was like, hey man, we were having fun despite the circumstances, one story that really sticks out in your head?
Yeah, many times I would say it was just the long walks to school, you know, you know, sixth grade, fifth grade, it was just, you know, 6 mile walks and, you know, it was a grind for sure, you know, and you would have so much time to just think about, you know, everything that you're going through. And, you know, but those were also the best times, and those were the times where, you know, I thought of football and thought of track, you know, and you would, you know, I was a kid to run and be juking out, you know, trees and just doing all types of stuff. If you were driving, you know, looking at me, you'll be like, what is this kid doing? You know? But that's because I always wanted to play football and I always wanted to, you know, share that experience that all my other classmates were doing, you know, they were playing football. So that's what made me, you know, were those long walks, but it was also tough at the time.
Right.
So you bring up football. So you start running track
Yep. And
playing football. Did you do both starting at the same time?
Starting at the same time, my junior year.
Of high school, right?
Yeah. So I always wanted to play, you know, I always played, you know, on the playground and everything, but we moved around a lot, so I never really had a chance to. But, you know, finally we got stable, you know, at Hart High School, and that's when, you know, I tried out for the team and made the team, you know, started doing track after football season, and, you know, I started doing high jump, actually. I thought I was a sprinter, but, you know, I went out there and I wasn't the fastest guy, so I was just playing around and did high jump, jumped like 6'6", and I was like, oh, let me, you know, continue doing this, and from there I just took over all the jumps and, you know, enjoyed that. As far as football, you know, I was always a playmaker. You know, once the ball was in my hands, you know, I was raw, you know, as a player. But once the ball was in my hands, it was like, you know, something special was going to happen.
Especially if there's trees on the field.
Right.
If you're playing in a forest, unstoppable.
Right. Trees, cars.
Right. Cars, lights, whatever's there.
Tell us a little bit more about, I mean, you became like an Olympic level triple jumper.
Yep.
Tell us about that progression and what it was like when you almost made it to the Olympics.
Yeah. Triple jump started off for me. I was the number one in the league for high jump and long jump. My junior year. So my senior year, I was like, there was one meet, I had an open event, and I was like, man, let me try and do triple jump. So, you know, I asked the coach, I was like, hey, I have an open event, you know, let me try to do triple jump. And he was like, okay, you know, sure. So my first jump, you know, I went off. I didn't even know what it was. He taught me at the spot what triple jump was. And I'm like, all right, my first jump, I jumped like 45. That put me like third in California State.
Holy cow. And
like top 10 in the nation. I'm like, okay. So after
I got the hang of this.
Right. After that, I just started getting, you know, used to it and, you know, getting familiar with it. And then, you know, I was top 2 in the state, top 3 in the nation, you know, after that. And from there, you know, I continued jumping at College of the Canyons, my junior college that I went to, and it was just awesome. You know, I felt really comfortable doing it. And, you know, from there, I jumped at the Pan American Games, you know, nationally, you know, in the national championship and won that, you know. So from there, I just felt like triple jump was something that I could do and, you know, I was just naturally good at.
So who's a better track star, you or Marlon Humphrey? You guys talk about this?
We haven't actually, but I'm not sure what his, you know, track background is actually.
Because what was his event?
I don't know. What was it?
I want to say it was hurdles, but I couldn't.
It might have been
I think it was hurdles.
I think it was hurdles.
I think it was, I mean, he didn't go to the Olympic trials, so.
Got it.
I'd say me, but anytime you have an opportunity to do it as a dual sport athlete in college, especially at universities, you know, big time universities that are, you know, big in football, you know, that's obviously a blessing. And Marlon was able to do both for a little bit of time at Alabama. And obviously I was able to my 2 years at Arizona State. So it just shows, you know, what kind of athletes we are and what kind of dedication and, you know, the hard work that we put in.
Did you debate ever, like, all right, I just want to solely focus on track and try to be an Olympian as my career, or how did football outweigh that?
Yeah, football was automatic. that was something that, you know, is a dream for me. And, you know, track was also, but football was something that I, you know, my passion is through the roof for. And that's something that, you know, I felt like I couldn't give up. So football was definitely something I approached and, you know, committed to 100%.
Have you ever tried to triple jump while, like, doing a punt or kick return?
I haven't, but I have leaped over a couple of people, so.
Were they like, what the?
Yeah, they were a little confused, looking back, like, all right. Dude just jumped over me.
So one thing that I think is so interesting for you guys when you go undrafted is how you are in a unique situation. Obviously, everyone wants to get drafted, right? Yeah. But then if you don't, you're in a unique situation where you can pick. And did you have offers from a number of different teams? What was that process for you?
Yeah, definitely offers from a number of different teams. And, you know, a lot came at me last minute, you know, like, hey, you know, offering big numbers or whatever. And I was just like, for me, you know, after my pro day, it was automatic. Like, I was looking at the Ravens roster. I was looking at the situation and the area, everything. So from that point, you know, I kind of already knew if, you know, I didn't get drafted, then I had them at the top, you know. So I already chose the Ravens if I didn't get drafted.
And why was that?
Like I said, I looked at the roster, I looked at the team, I looked at the history that you guys have had, and, you know, I was like, man, I need to be a part of it. You know, I want to be here. So that's what I'm gonna strive for. And I put it, you know, out in the air, and it's exactly what happened. You know, I had the chance to choose, and, you know, teams came at me with bigger offers, but I was like, I already set my mind up, you know, that I'm going to be a Raven. So let me go do this. I already created my guy on Madden and all that stuff. So I gave him my number. I was ready for it.
Do you know Jermaine Lewis? Did you come across him in Ravens history? Because you kind of remind me of him. He was a returner here during the Super Bowl year in 2000. He was like kind of a smaller guy, like you, really fast kind of guy. You know, unlike, you think of great Ravens returners, you think of Jacoby and Jermaine.
Exactly.
Jacoby's like a taller, kind of
longer
guy. You kind of remind me of Jermaine a little bit.
Yeah, I'm sure. So he brings up the returner thing. I'm sure part of the reason that when you look at the roster, you're thinking about the teams, you look at the returner position, you say there's an opening. You know, how have you felt just kind of in that transition from a football standpoint of being out there during OTAs and minicamp and feeling like, all right, I can return at the NFL level?
Yeah. Well, like I said earlier, you know, growing up, you know, I was really raw, you know, to start my football career. But one of the things that, you know, was a part of me is that once the ball's in my hand, there was something that was going to happen, you know. So, you know, once I'm out here and, you know, doing OTAs and mini camps, I felt really good about coming out here and catching punts and, you know, returning kick returns. You know, that's just something I worked really hard at, you know, at Arizona State, and something that's a part of me I take high pride in and, you know, want to go out there and make plays. So I felt real comfortable. That's the most comfortable position that, you know, I feel at right now.
Hey, can't have enough playmakers.
Exactly.
Right. Exactly.
Cool. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, man. It was a pleasure talking to you.
All right, thanks to Tim. Really enjoyed just kind of learning about his story.
Yeah.
Another person with an interesting story is Taequann Mizell, running back from Virginia. So let's jump into it with Taequann.
Taequann, really happy to have you.
Thank
we
you
just kind of want to, yeah, we want to introduce you to fans a little bit more. And I think we got to start out with a nickname. All right, nickname Smoke, which is pretty much the most badass nickname I've ever heard for a football player. That is sick. How did you get the nickname?
Well, I started off in high school, my freshman year. You know, I played varsity, but then, you know, get as much playing time, yeah. But I was used as like a tackling dummy for like the starters. So I used to, we used to do this little open field tackling drill, and none of our older guys could tackle me in open field. So our head coach ended up coming up with that name my ninth grade year, and it stuck with me ever since.
That's awesome. Yeah. So throughout college, everybody called you Smoke.
Throughout that college, was it. Yep. So Coach Lennon started calling me that, and then you know, as things started to turn up for me, you know, started with the success at UVA, you know, the announcer. Then professors, students, it was just crazy.
That's awesome. That's yeah. And it proved true. I mean, you are a really tough guy to bring down. You set ACC records, all-time ACC record holder for most yards receiving and rushing, over 1,500 yards, mm-hmm. first player to ever do that. I mean, did you go into college thinking like, yeah, I could kind of set ACC records, or did it even take you by surprise?
It kind of took me by surprise. Actually, you know, coming in, it was kind of rough. So, like, coming out of high school, you know, being like a five-star and all those things, it was like a lot of pressure built up on me, you know, a lot of pressure that you don't ask for. And then I came in my freshman year, you know, I had a high ankle sprain injury. I missed a couple games. Then they like, oh, this guy, you know, the big time five star, where is he at? And then my sophomore year, it was a lot better. I was used as a third down back, jet sweep type of guy. And then once I had my chance to start, I had my last 2 years to start, I was just like, you know, I'm going to block out all the outside noise, focus on what I could focus on. And I had a new coaching staff. Coach Beatty came in, helped me out a lot. And we just took off from there. You know, they changed the offense, using me a lot, you know, mixed matches and, you know, changing the run game. And it was just me just taking advantage of all those opportunities.
Wow. So it's crazy. It was only really 2 years as a starter and you mm-hmm. still set the records. Because I would have thought you were starting as a freshman, kind of build on it.
Not at all.
That's nutty.
Yeah, I think my junior year was probably the first time I ever, besides high school, even got like 10 carries a game.
Wow.
Yep.
So how the heck, when you put up all the stats like that, do you go undrafted? That's the golden question, I think, here, the million-dollar question.
That's something I can't even really
you gotta ask all
get
these
into.
GMs.
Yeah, so with that process, I definitely thought I would get drafted. You know, it started off, you know, I kind of saw some of it unfolding. You know, I didn't get an invite to the combine.
Right.
I saw, like, other backs that I even got higher praise, you know, well, all ACC, whatever it was.
Right. Higher awards and all that stuff.
Right, get invited to the combine. I was like, wow, that's interesting or whatever. So I still try to, you know, just stay prayed up and focus on what I can control. And then, no Senior Bowl, I've got a late invite to the NFLPA Bowl, and I took a lot of pride in that. So that week, you know, I was focused on, I want to show them that I'm not only just the best running back here, because all the running backs there, maybe besides one, got a combine invite, and I didn't. Mm. And I was like, I'm just focused on, I had a chip on my shoulder. So going into that game, I had a great week of practice. I ended up breaking their rushing record in the game, and still no combine invite.
Wow.
But it was all good.
Does that one take place after the Senior Bowl and all that stuff, or
actually it was like right before the Senior Bowl. So actually, some people, I know somebody I trained with actually got a Reese Bowl invite from that game.
Interesting.
So,
but you didn't.
Nah.
We got to talk to Phil Savage. Head of that. He's a former Ravens guy.
I know our class
about this.
Yeah, I know our class, like the running back class this past year was pretty stacked. But, you know, I kind of looked at myself as being different. You know, I felt like it was a lot of guys in the draft class. You know, it's a lot of us, or a lot of them, that can run for 1,000 yards. But, like, what can you do to separate yourself from those guys?
Right.
And I take pride on, like, catching the ball, you know, running routes out of the backfield. And, you know, I just let God take control.
Right.
So you don't get the Senior Bowl invite, you don't get the combine invite.
Mm-hmm.
And then the way that, you know, our scouts always talk about how they'll kind of turn over every stone to find different guys. And one of the big events that they do every year is they have a local pro day. Mm-hmm. And you participated in that, mm-hmm. right? I mean, so, and I think that, is that one of the things that put you on the radar of the scouts here?
No, definitely. So that's what, that was the feedback that I got from our running back coach here. So basically, leading up to the local pro day, I had like a couple visits with a couple teams, and I actually missed a date, and we had to reschedule it. So I came here. It was like the hardest workout that I had of all teams. It was like the hardest one. But I had a couple workouts for like different teams, the 49ers, Chargers, and all those guys, and the other ones was visits. So I came here, and the individual period was only like 5 minutes long, but it was nonstop the whole entire time. So I couldn't, and I just had got off a flight and all that stuff, like doing all that traveling. So, you know, I did the individual period, and then I had to get the chance to run routes for the coaching staff, and I ran routes from the running back spot and the receiver spot, and I caught punts for at least like 30, 40 minutes or whatever. So after, you know, they was really impressed with what they saw, and when I was speaking to our running back coach, he said that he really didn't know who I was besides, like, from high school. You know, he really wasn't big on me of, like, what – I guess he didn't see nothing prior to me, like, leading up to that moment. So from that day, that's when they started looking into the film or whatever it is, and I've been in contact with them ever since. And then I had, from that day, I kind of knew that they wasn't planning on drafting it back, but it was like if I was to slide out of the draft, they would be interested in me, you know, whatever it was. So, and looking towards like the draft, they didn't draft any like backs or any offensive players, so they kept their word, and that was a big reason, you know, and me sticking with my decision after I went undrafted.
So it was when you were making the decision after you go undrafted, one of the reasons you chose here is because you're saying that they kept their word and saying they were going to pursue you, they wanted you.
Mm-hmm. That was probably the worst and the best day of my life. Like,
really?
That was that decision. I was with my mom. We actually cried of frustration and tears of joy at the same time. Like, it was, like, right after the draft, like, so many phone calls. And you got to make, like, the biggest decision of your life within, like, 5 minutes because they got to go on to the next person to try to fill those spots. And I actually was almost committed to another team, and then coach called me and we ended up figuring everything out, and I was just like, you know what, I was like, me and my mom just talked about it, I just went with my gut feeling, I said I'm going to Baltimore.
Wow. Nice. Was it Coach Hammack that called? Is that the one that you talked to? And he was the one that kind of made the final pitch to sell you on coming coach here?
Nice. How much have you learned from Danny Woodhead? Because, you know, he's also a back that does a lot as a receiver.
Right.
So how much have you kind of followed what he does?
It's a lot you can learn from him. Obviously, you know, me playing, like, the same role he play is awesome, you know, just to get the chance to just be up under his wing. So just a lot, you know, just far as his knowledge of the game, you know, just to take that part of the game as serious as possible. You know, the guy, he's not the biggest guy. I'm not the biggest guy.
Right.
But that man played in the league how many years?
8 years or something
Nine years. And that's something that I want to accomplish. So I'm like, how did he do that? How did he, you know, stick around that long? And I can tell, like, when he's on the field, he's the smartest player probably on the field. You know, the quarterback, you know, they always smart, but he's probably one of the smartest players on the field. Mm-hmm. You know, you can learn from a lot, you know, running routes. You know, I'm a big-time dude on, like, running routes, but it's a lot you can learn from watching him run routes, just his patience, the way he sets you up, and just catching everything for real.
Right. Well, I remember watching practice, and us reporters, you know, we're always looking for, like, something to just kind of stand out a little bit, you know, because practice, you know, it's interesting for you guys. Sometimes for us, it gets a little slow. But I specifically remember you going up and making a one-hander by the sideline, like, early on in the OTAs, I want to say. You remember this one?
That was rookie minicamp.
Was it rookie minicamp? Okay, yeah. And I remember all the reporters, we were like, everybody see that one? We're all looking around like, all right, let's write that one down. Yeah. So I think you've definitely made an impression.
Right.
Yeah, so thank you so much, Smoke. Really appreciate
it. Thank y'all.
Yeah, fans are going to really like watching you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Taquan. As he exits, we welcome in Ricky Ortiz.
We're just running them through today.
It's
an assembly line here on the podcast.
Assembly line of great interviews. So here comes Ricky, fullback slash linebacker, fullback here. But he played just about everything at Oregon State. Here's Ricky Ortiz.
Let's talk about fullback, first of all. The Ravens signed you as an undrafted rookie free agent right after Kyle Juszczyk leaves. So you got to be like, nice, here we go, open fullback spot, let's do this thing. What was behind your decision to sign with the Ravens and your reaction when you saw that you had that open shot?
Well, I think that it started with getting a phone call, an early phone call from Coach Hammack, and really sensing the confidence in his voice that I was his guy.
Right.
You know, that I was number one on his list for fullback. And I thought it was a perfect opportunity. I mean, he talked about Juice and, how he developed here and how he had the chance to coach him. So I thought it would be a great opportunity for myself, to be put in a position where I could become that elite fullback, and be able to be versatile like I was in the offense at Oregon State, And so just having that opportunity really and just taking advantage of it while I'm here, has been probably one of the bigger things that I think that will kind of lead me to become the best that I can be at that spot. So,
in looking at Juice, it seems like when you're in college and you're thinking about, okay, I'm going to try to make this jump to the NFL level, do you look at a guy like Kyle and say, like, that is the kind of role? Is he sort of like the model of, like, the new fullback in today's game?
You know what? At first, I didn't study a lot of the fullbacks because at Oregon State, I played every spot. I played linebacker, fullback, tight end, H-back.
Quarterback.
Returner.
slot receiver. After really getting into the film, my father, talked to me before my senior season, and we both agreed that I was fullback. It was just what the team needed at the time, and he talked to me about DeMarco from the Falcons, who just got signed by the Bills on a bigger contract, and he talked to me, and then he talked to me. He said, "Hey, watch Juice," and I started watching their highlights and I saw a lot of similarities, between my game and their game. I mean, they're both, great fullbacks in the league right now. So, kind of studying, those guys and, seeing what they bring to the table and knowing that I'm very similar in that fact. I think it was going to set me up, to have a good shot at the next level. So, I would say that Juice and both DeMarco, from the Falcons were great examples to me, and they represented just something that I wanted to become when I stepped foot in the league.
So I know that Juice would always get mad when we would ask him about whether fullback's a dying breed. He got tired of that question by the end of his 4 years here. So I'll get you sour on the question right from the start here. So are fullbacks a dying breed?
I don't think so. And that's because, this past two teams in the Super Bowl, they had fullbacks.
Yeah.
So, I came from both pro style and then switched to a spread offense my last 2 years at Oregon State, so I know both sides of the things. But I think that, fullback is essential to an offense. They bring so much to the table. They're just physical. You want that physical guy coming through the hole, leading the running back either on ISO or, outside zone or power. You want that physical feeling, to come from that guy, that presence. And, you can't factor out a fullback if you want to have a balanced offense. So I say that, the fullback spot is not a dying breed. I say it's coming back even more. I love personally watching Allstott when he played for the...
He was all
I love playing Madden with Mike Allstott, just trucking people.
Yeah.
Those old school Madden teams with Allstott and then Warwick Dunn. Thunder and Lightning.
Oh, yeah. Nasty.
Yeah, just watching those guys, watching him play, that physicality, you can't replace that. You got to have that guy in the offense. I like to call it the linebacker of the offense.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have that physical guy, that physical presence, like I said. And to answer your question, I don't think it's about
Ricky. This is where you got to flip the question on Garrett and say, "Well, Garrett, Are journalists a dying breed? Huh? Yeah, writers? Yeah. Your profession is dying, Garrett.
Right, right.
And mine.
Yeah, that's your profession.
But anyway, speaking of professions, we got to get into your other profession here,
oh, yeah.
Which is being an avocado farmer, which is pretty awesome. Not a bad fallback. So you got to tell us a story. How did you first get into avocado farming?
It was back in the day, man. It was in middle school with me and my buddy Adrian Contreras. You know, I've told this story many times, but, you know, it's developing. I mean, our ideas, you know, have just been kind of floating around in middle, you know, since middle school. And, you know, they came to life and, you know, we saw just a great market, a great opportunity for us as, you know, business partners. And we took advantage of it. His dad owned land down in Mexico. So, you know, being that he's a dual citizen, it enabled us to actually start planting avocado trees. So then from, I don't know how many years going back now, say 13, so about 10, 11 years since we started that, it's just grown. I mean, the market's, it's incredible. Just watching the market, you know, the prices are going up. I mean, consumer demand is high, so
gotta get that avocado.
Yeah, I got avocado on everything. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you see the prices. My dad prices them all the time. I mean, he sees them now at $2.99 an avocado at some stores in California. So I don't know if that's due to Trump's tax on the border, but because, you know, with those taxes that he's inflicting, all the farmers are going to do is raise their price, which they're still making the same. So I don't know how beneficial that is to that tax. But
here we go. This is my guy right here. But,
yeah, so we have some we definitely are focusing more on guacamole, I think. And I think that's going to be pretty huge for us. We're trying to, you know, make it more of a sports business, so kind of get some of the NFL guys, and by guys I mean guys that we think that are fit for positions in our company, and kind of use them. I mean, market the business, use them as investors. I mean, I have a couple buddies in the league, so, and I think that they would be great fits for, you know, our company. And not only would we be impacting, you know, one area or targeting one area, you would be hearing it, you know, around the country in different organizations. And I think that that's something that we kind of we're going to, you know, go for and make a business plan for. So right now it's about getting those machines up and ready. And then from there, I mean, everything's USDA certified with the trees. So, you know, as far as that goes, it's all good. So I would say just really focusing on building our team next and building that business plan, getting those machines and then getting stuff started, kind of advertising a little bit more with the league. You know, it's a great way to advertise. The NFL has done a great job of advertising guacamole and avocados. So, you know, it would be pretty cool to just get in on that and, yeah. You know, hopefully just start taking off.
How many avocados do you, like, produce on an annual basis?
Yeah, so it's annually. I mean, we have, I mean, it produces, harvest is year-round, so you could probably, I'd say, range from, like, 200. It depends on the avocado tree, but there's 200 and 250 a tree, so you multiply that by however many trees you have, which is like 200,000 for us. So
that's a lot of
guacamole, man. And yeah. You know what? What's cool about that is that you could actually target some of the other farmers for guacamole. The avocado, nobody sees what avocado. I mean, the avocado. There's a lot of avocados that fall to the ground. So being sustainable and being a sustainable company means for us is like actually taking those avocados off of other farmers' hands and start making the guacamole out of it. And sometimes
they just otherwise throw them out. Sell the avocado.
Can't sell them to the market. You can't put them in the market because they don't look like they're red. Some of them are red. They're sunburnt. They've been on the ground, so you don't sell those avocados, but they're perfectly good. Huh. So in a sustainable way, we wanted to take advantage of that and really aim, you know, towards just using that as more product, because I mean Jalisco, the state of Jalisco in Mexico is just it's swarming with avocado. So I mean, there's tons of farmers out there, and it'd be pretty easy to take those off their hands and actually use that as part of our product.
Interesting. Well, you got big plans ahead of you.
Tons of them.
Dude, this guacamole recipe I was asking about.
That's a secret. So
you gave it to me.
I can't just tell everybody on this podcast.
No, you didn't give it to me. Well, but I'm going to invite him to, you know, if we're not playing the Super Bowl, Ricky's getting an invite to my Super Bowl party. Yeah. He's a guacamole guy.
I've been working on it. I made guacamole the other day. It's, you know, I've got my own.
It's hard. It's hard to mess it up. Put it that way. It's kind of hard to mess it up.
It's true.
You can put a ton of ingredients in it. You could use sour cream, whatever you want.
Simple is better, right?
Yeah, simple. I think simple is better. But for me, I like not using sour cream. Just right. kind of going, just going natural and adding whatever you want to add. You want to spice it up. Mm-hmm. Spice it up, put some whatever kind of chili you want to put in there, but there's a lot of things you can do with it. You can make smoothies out of it, and that's something that my mom just started doing, so it's pretty cool. Pretty cool stuff.
Have you have avocado ice cream?
I have not. So
pretty
that's
nice. You would have avocado ice cream. Yeah, I've
never even heard
far.
Of that until now.
But we have balls for being
that just shows you how diverse avocado is, though. So
see, this is I'm going to have a branch of your business here. Avocado ice cream.
I don't think there's this huge craving for avocado ice cream.
Everyone there's going to be. They said the same thing about guacamole 50 years ago.
Guacamole? Who wants that?
Yeah.
Ricky Ortiz, pleasure, man.
Thank you guys for having me.
Appreciate it. All right, thanks to Ricky, and I still don't understand why you like avocado ice cream. There's some things that are meant to be ice cream, are meant to be, you know, there's...
My brother-in-law just had asparagus ice cream.
Yeah, that's disgusting. You know,
he said it was delicious.
There's no need to make asparagus ice cream. That just...
It's healthy. You make healthy ice cream. Avocado ice cream.
But I don't want healthy ice cream.
Why not?
I want
You can just
ice
have
cream.
The best of both worlds.
It's not the best of both worlds because it's still asparagus ice cream. If I want ice cream, I want something good. I'll throw some peanut butter in there, throw some sort of chocolate in there.
I would argue with you on the
That's
peanut butter.
That's what I want in my ice cream. I don't want
Shout
carrots.
Shout out to my nutty buddy out there. Peanut butter.
I don't want carrots and asparagus and avocado and kale ice cream. That is ridiculous. Don't give me any of that
I
crap.
I like all that stuff. Quick story. This
People
is
like you
little...
just ruin good things. People like you ruin good things.
No. We make good things even better.
Now I need spinach ice cream. This is what's wrong with this country. Go ahead.
That's what's wrong with this country. Quick story on the avocado. This is just a, you know, words of the wise for all you listeners out there. Never sign up to be the guacamole person to a party. You know, when they say everybody brings something, don't sign up for the guacamole. My wife made this mistake a couple years ago for our Christmas party / holiday party. For the department here, she says, yeah, we'll bring the guacamole. Then you have 30 people at the party, right? That's a lot of avocados. That's like Ricky's entire tree farm.
I know.
So we have to buy. We go to the Trader Joe's to get avocados, and I'm like, babe, we got like 10 bags. It costs us like $50 to bring this thing. I could have bought a pie for $5.
Yeah.
We dropped $50. Bring a ton of... We came seriously with a wheelbarrow full of guacamole. Guess how much got eaten? Guess how much?
Well, I was there, but I'd say a fair amount of the guacamole got eaten, but...
That did not even hardly put a dent in it.
When you came in with a 5-gallon drum and people eat 1 gallon of it, you still have a lot of avocados left over.
Seriously. You know how brown that got in my fridge? I'm sitting there.
You probably did try to recycle that and keep it. Refrigerated.
Oh, absolutely. I took it back home. I put the pits in it. I tried to eat.
It never works.
I was picking around little brown spots for a little while. You know me.
It never works.
I'm cheap. I don't throw stuff
out.
Yeah,
and you still, this was probably like 3 years ago that this happened. And you,
still working on it.
Well, yeah. You probably still have it in your fridge somewhere. Thinking there's a green probably, spot somewhere at the bottom. You just got to pick through it. But you use that to try to get out of bringing anything for the Christmas party. Well, three years ago, I brought guacamole.
Now I'm like I'm the soda guy. Yeah, I'll bring the two liter of Coke and the Sprite.
I'll bring napkins.
Exactly. That's my job now.
Yeah.
You have the onus is on you to bring the good stuff.
Just a bad party guest. anyway, really enjoyed all three of these interviews with Ricky, Tim, and Taekwon. It was fun to get to know all of them, have unique stories. And I think all three of them, they're going to push for a roster spot.
If not on the 53, then on the practice squad. These are guys to root for
Yeah, it's easy. You can see why that they're likable. people.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
As always, if you have questions, comments, emails that you want to share with us, you can do that by emailing us at thelounge@ravens.nfl.net. We also want to encourage you guys to leave a rating and a review on iTunes. You know, sometimes there's a lot of them coming in. Lately, it's been a little stagnant. We need, you know, step up.
Yeah. And just have to let you know that we will not have an episode of the podcast next week during the 4th of July break. The whole company is basically given the week off. Thank you very much, Stevie B. and so we will not have one next week, and I will not be here the following 2 weeks.
Mink is going to be out for the next 6 weeks.
It's going to be great.
There's only got to be somebody. There's somebody here that has to keep this place afloat, and it, generally speaking, is always me.
You'll find me in Amsterdam, Belgium, and France, good sir.
Yeah. Again, not pulling your weight. And I've got to get the job done. But luckily for the listeners of the podcast, I am here, and I will not relent.
Well, thank you very much for listening, and we'll be back soon.